he snorted. Please, I do this for a living. Laura didn't see an advantage in denying it. She nodded. That's good. Perfect, in fact. You two are going to produce an article for me. Pretty much the one I'm sure you're already planning to write. And you're going to add a few things. Or what? He smacked the tabletop. The girl's alive, Laura. It's different now. Besides, nothing I'm asking you to print is incorrect. What is it, then? Inflammatory. That might be the best word. You're trying to make him angry. I'm trying to communicate with him. Emotionally. And you want to use my paper, my byline, to do it. That's our only shot. Right now they're working over that entire package and looking for physical evidence. But I don't have high hopes. And believe it or not, he didn't leave a return address. This is it, Laura. This is the only way I have to reach him. She gritted her teeth some more, blew air out between them. Will you help me? He asked. She looked down at the tabletop, then back up at him. That depends. Can I keep the pictures? Chapter 16. Bass Herman had never paced before, not to her knowledge. But he was doing it now, racing up and down the length of his office like he'd been stung in the ass by a hornet. What a response! Do you know what this means for us? More exposure? Laura said. She didn't bother to look up and kept jotting notes in the margins of a half-written article. Of course, more exposure. Hey, up here. She finished writing and then raised her head. He had his hands on his hips, feet shoulder-width apart and planted dead center in the room. Are you listening? Of course, she said. Which was a lie. It was Monday afternoon, almost 24 hours since Tominski had shown her those pieces of Teresa Mitchum. Laura had expected they would keep her up nights, and it turned out she'd been half right. The previous night had been spent tossing and turning and sweating through her sheets. But it wasn't the photos keeping her awake. It was the phone call. She couldn't get his voice out of her head. Every time her eyelids had started to flutter, she heard it like a whisper just behind her. I'm watching you. She'd jump and turn around, and when she was sure there was no one behind her, start the process all over again. That meant triple-checking the lock on the farmhouse door, nudging all the windows deeper into their sockets, peering behind curtains and under beds. Satisfied there was no intruder, she'd sprawl on top of her covers, hands behind her head, and try to go to sleep. I'm watching you right now. At 5 in the morning, she deemed it hopeless, ate an early breakfast, picked up a copy of the Gazette, and arrived at the office a full 2 hours before anyone else. Now the lack of sleep was catching up with her. Are you listening? Bass asked again. She jumped at the sound of his voice. Sorry, just a little tired. Well, you worked hard. You earned it. You know how many calls I've gotten this morning? You should see the list. Just the ones with Times in the title. New York Times, L.A. Times, Times-Picayune, Sun-Times. It goes on. They're all picking up the story, Laura. She yawned. It's a good story. He sat down behind the desk, looking perplexed. I thought this was what you wanted. Your name on the front page.
They're all printing it on the front page?
He scowled. Don't be glib. He was right, of course. This was exactly what she had been working for. Since the beginning, something in her gut had alerted her that this was the story, the one that could pick her up and fly her to wherever she wanted to go. Not that it had been a difficult distinction to make. Stories set in Hillsborough weren't exactly famous for being noteworthy. As though he could read her mind, Bass Herman echoed the same sentiment. You should be thankful.
To you?
Sure as hell should be thankful to me, he muttered. Not that I'm holding my breath, but I didn't mean it like that. A story that can capture national interest doesn't come along every day. You got lucky.
You got lucky. The same phrase that had been echoing around inside her head since day one. Since the very first time she'd heard about Olive Hansen laying out in that field. Somewhere between her initial excitement and the moment in the motel room last night, holding a picture of a girl's severed ear. Her enthusiasm had evaporated. All she had left was a dry mouth with a sour taste in it, one she couldn't get rid of. How long would that last, she wondered.
Let's talk about the new article, he said.
She briefed him on Tominsky's plan, careful to avoid naming her secret source, and presented the psychological workup as the natural progression of a story people were hungry to consume. She'd expected him to put up a fight, but Bass, a man she'd heard pontificate on journalistic ethics more times than she could count, had only one thing to say about printing wild speculation under the banner of news.
We can run it this week. It'll sell a lot of papers.
And now the story had exploded even further, was getting picked up by dailies all over the country. She stared at him, wondering how long it would be until she could actually see the dollar signs in his eyes. Dr. Devane has agreed to put in her 2 cents. The two of us can work something up that walks a fine line. We can minimize our exposure, keep it circumspect. We'll cover the serial killer thing in general, do a walkthrough of some of the greats, what made them tick, stuff like that.
Keep talking.
It's a psychological profile piece, you know, an attempt to answer the question, what kind of person could do this?
And what's the answer?
Well, I don't exactly know yet. Based on my conversations with Dr. Devane, it's a simple question with a very complicated answer. Really, there is no answer, which makes it all the more terrible if you ask me. Bass tapped a fingernail against one of his front teeth.
People don't like complicated.
No, they generally don't.
Maybe we can simplify it?
He asked hopefully. Human psychology? Like you said, don't hold your breath. But the thing is, Bass, it doesn't matter. It's the question that's on everyone's mind. Who could do this? What kind of person? How did he get like this?
And if we want an article, we need an answer.
Sure, but you're missing the point. The answer doesn't matter. What matters is that people are asking the question. All we have to do is claim to have the answer. Claim to know the truth. Even just a version of it. We print that in big black letters at the top of the front page, and they'll come running. Agree with us. Disagree with us. It won't matter. They'll buy all the same. Asking those kinds of questions leaves a kind of hole in the world that people can't explain. They'll fill it any way they can.
Agree or disagree has nothing to do with it. We're talking about news, after all.
She stood to go. Sure we are, Bass, she said. Sure we are. The oppressive heat broke late Monday night, and by Tuesday morning the mercury had returned to the 80s. But the coolness of Jasmine Devane's office was as welcome as ever. Laura rested her head against the wall and let the air of the waiting room suck the sweat off her skin. The inner door opened, and Jasmine entered next to a tall, lanky woman with sun-blasted features that marked a lifetime on a farm. Wet tracks streaked through the dust on her cheeks. A damp tissue jutted out of one hand.
Same time next week, Rhonda?
Jasmine said. Rhonda nodded, and her features crumpled, threatening tears again. The doctor put a hand on her shoulder. Just remember, it's okay to be your own person. Talk with your friends. Get out of the house. Rhonda nodded again and pushed out through the door, sniffling. Jasmine gestured and Laura followed her into the office. Difficult patient? Jasmine let herself tip into one of the overstuffed armchairs.
Hardly.
You look tired, though.
Oh, I am. Tired like a woman working an assembly line. This must be what it feels like to put together lipsticks all day. Slide the lipstick in the tube, screw the top on, repeat, again and again.
A machine probably does that. Jasmine threw her hands up into the air.
If there's any justice in the world.
So, not a difficult patient.
When it comes to difficulty, most people linger near the center of the bell curve. It's like I told you, 7,000 people and not a single mental health professional. There's a lot of low-hanging fruit to deal with.
But we shouldn't talk about that. It's okay to tell me that kind of thing. I won't go spreading it around town.
I'm not saying you would, but that still doesn't make it appropriate to the doctor-patient relationship.
What is, getting drunk and starting bar fights? She regretted it the minute she said it. The attempt at levity fell flat. A darkness descended over Jasmine's face like a storm cloud.
That was a mistake.
I thought we went over this already, Laura said.
In the wake of Tominski's revelations, she'd made a few phone calls to Jasmine, shoring up her agreement to do the article. We went over it, but it doesn't change anything. I was way out of line to even end up in that situation. Look, I'm sorry, okay? Jasmine shook her head. You've got nothing to be sorry for. You're the patient, I'm the doctor. The responsibility to avoid compromising situations is on my end. They sat in silence for a few minutes. Finally, Laura said, It was fun though, right? Most fun I've had in weeks. But that doesn't change a thing. Let's stick to business then. Let's talk about the article. She frowned. What have I gotten myself into? Hey, you already agreed to do it, and I already sold it to my boss. If it's my mental well-being you're interested in protecting, I'd better make sure you keep your job, Jasmine said. Got it. And I'm as good as my word. But this is the last time I get mixed up with one of my patients outside this room. Patient. Laura had to admit the word stung. She didn't have any real friends in Hillsborough, and she'd come to think of Jasmine as more than just her therapist. Jasmine caught the look on her face. What? Just thinking about the kid. Any early conclusions? I read through everything you gave me, drew up some notes. It's nothing revelatory. Just the same old song and dance about psychopathy. Deputy Rogers drew some startling conclusions about the voyeuristic nature of the crimes. Sheriff Rogers, Laura corrected her. Deputy Rogers at the time. He went on to be sheriff? Doesn't surprise me. He had a sharp mind. His conclusion was that the crime itself, the murder of these girls, was secondary. It was just a foundation, a building block in a larger plan. Seeing the reactions was more important than the act itself. Do you put any stock in the idea that he's local? Someone living right here? Jasmine nodded. Very much so. Rogers didn't have the experience in clinical work to make some of the connections. Plus, the literature on serial killers was much smaller back then. But his ideas dovetail with what we know now. She stood, walked to the drapes, and pushed one aside to let in more light. Serial killers work in cycles, and those cycles are predictable, even if they're changing. These kinds of people have been thinking about their fantasy, whatever it is, for most of their life. It builds up like pressure in a steam pipe. One day, the pipe bursts. They kill someone. Then what happens? Laura shook her head. She didn't know. They stop for a while. Physically, at least, the fantasy sustains them again. It's much stronger now, fueled by details of the actual act. Terrible, of course, but this also prevents them from killing for a while. I sense a but coming. But, Jasmine said, over time, this refractory period seems to last fewer and fewer months. Before long, it's down to weeks, then only days. How does that relate to the kid? Well, if Rogers was right, this man would be nearly unique in his pathology. He'd get his kicks from the interactions with living people, and those interactions would far outnumber his murders. Every news article, every discussion with people on the street, every expression of horror, they'd be like manna from heaven. His murders are a spectacle, and he gets to move among the audience, invisible. She took a breath. It must be a feeling of great power, godlike even. Is that how he sees himself, a god? She shook her head. I don't think so. Why? Just a feeling. He is highly organized and very careful. But if your end goal is never to be caught, these kinds of crimes are not how you do it. He wants to get caught? Not at all. But I suspect he accepts it as an inevitability. The same way you or I accept our mortality. We're just human beings, after all. So is he. He knows that. The knot in Laura's stomach returned with a vengeance, the pain so sharp it felt like she'd been stabbed. Can you sit down? Jasmine turned to face her. Are you all right? Your face is quite pale. Just sit, she said. And when the doctor was across from her, she took a minute before speaking. He called me. Who? Laura fixed her with a look. I don't believe it, Jasmine said. Yes, it was him. Oh, he showed you some ID? He said enough. Laura related the details of the phone call, especially the part about the rocky outcropping on the ridge. When she was finished, she said, How could he have known about that unless he's exactly who he claims to be? Jasmine thought a minute, then said. You told only Agent Tominski about the cigarette butts. Laura nodded. And who did he tell?
No one.
You're sure? He said he wouldn't. You're a newspaper reporter, not his partner. Do I really need to tell you that police officers, even FBI agents, lie routinely during the course of their duties?
How would you know?
Jasmine waved a hand in disgust. Please, I testified in more than my fair share of trials back in Chicago, usually for the defense. The Chicago Police Department wanted to put every single mentally ill person in jail, and proof of incapacity rarely dissuaded them. Interrogations are state-sanctioned lies designed to elicit a confession. You know this.
Laura nodded.
Jasmine wasn't wrong. The police did often lie as part of an investigation.
So what are you suggesting?
That you're not exactly popular with local law enforcement right now? Say Tominski told even one other person. The story could spread, could find its way to someone who would use it against you.
You really think that's what happened?
Laura asked. No, I'm not making a judgment call. You told me you had proof, that you're 100% certain this call was from the kid. I'm just pointing out that the proof is a little shaky.
Okay, Laura said slowly.
But based on the details, was it him?
What's your gut tell you?
Jasmine looked at the ceiling for a few seconds, then back down.
Maybe.
Come on, that's it?
I'm sorry, Laura, but a second-hand conversation isn't an ideal tool for analysis. I might as well be playing telephone with the guy. The situation doesn't exactly lend itself to strong conclusions.
Laura dug into her bag, pulled out a notebook and pencil, and balanced them on her knee.
Next question, she said.
Jasmine shook her head. No, this is your session. We need to talk about you. We can start in on the details at the end of the hour, but the rest of this time has to be for you.
This is for me. This is all I'm thinking about.
Come on, I know that's not true. I got your message.
Laura cringed. She'd made another call to Jasmine's office Sunday morning after her encounter with Smythe. She'd called filled with fear and rage and a cocktail of other emotions. More than anything, though, she'd wanted to share her resolve. It was Jasmine, after all, who had inspired her.
I figured you forgot about it.
Of course not, Jasmine said.
But you didn't bring it up.
Not until now, no. Adequate time and privacy are important.
She tapped the side of her head.
I can't do it right now. It's one extra thing to turn over in here, and my mind is full up. There's no more space.
Laura, it's taking up space whether you want it to or not. Talking about it is the only way to get it out.
There's nothing to say. He's a prick.
A dangerous prick. Have you considered going to the police?
Yes, I considered it.
Jasmine waited for her to continue and, when she didn't, said, and decided not to, I take it.
Laura leaned closer and started talking with her hands.
It doesn't work, see? I say he did, he says he didn't. His little girlfriend backs him up and no one believes me. It's a credibility issue, understand? I have a lot of experience with those.
That's a risk, to be sure.
So is doing nothing.
I need to do my job.
You know, I didn't have the best relationship with my mother either, and
Laura threw back her head and laughed.
I never figured you for such a Freudian. I mean, I know I talked about my mother when I first came in, but she's not tied into everything.
No, let me finish.
I didn't have the best relationship with my mother, and she didn't have the best relationship with men. To her, men were all the same. Simple, boorish creatures, fated for violence. God's ultimate joke was to sculpt that evil into their very natures, and then make them stronger than us, faster than us. To my mother, the result was inevitable. We were destined to be under a man's thumb, born to be slaves. She saw my whole life as an opportunity to spit in the face of that plan. I was adopted, and she saw me as her most important project. She colored my views to match hers. For a long time, I thought men were my enemy.
You don't think so anymore?
Laura asked, even after reading those files.
Jasmine's eyes snapped into focus.
Don't be reductive, she scoffed. Of course I don't. Men, women, it doesn't matter. Human nature is the enemy. The worst humanity has to offer is very bad indeed. but it doesn't seem to discriminate along gender lines. I don't see what this has to do with a prick named Colin Smythe. You're right, of course, I'm rambling. My point is that for a long time after I got out of my house, I felt like right and wrong were concepts without any inherent value. They had meaning, but there was just no way to put them into action. Basically, I didn't believe people would do anything if I pointed out an injustice. My mother had me convinced of her philosophy, that the world is a scary place, and a cry for help serves only to summon the monsters, Lara said. But now you're saying a cry for help is the right move. It can be. I don't know if they'll put the mayor's son in jail over one report. But until you try, how do you know yours will be the first? Lara chewed that over, and Jasmine seemed perfectly content to stare off into space. After a while, Lara asked, What happened to your mother? I shouldn't have brought it up. Really, I'm interested. It's not a good story. No happy ending. When I was 18, I left. And later on, she died. We never reconciled. I went to the funeral, certain I would find something there. Answers, I guess. But life doesn't work like that. What made you start questioning her? You mean her views on the less fair sex? Jasmine smiled. I fell in love. That can't have been easy. In that house, it was a nightmare. We used to send each other letters and code. The school's copy of Romeo and Juliet was the key. A little on the nose, to be sure. But as a 17-year-old, it was the most romantic thing I could imagine. Coded messages, Lara repeated. Yes, what's wrong? You look even paler than before. Lara rose out of her seat and started for the door. The good doctor shouted something after her, but she couldn't make it out and didn't bother to try. Three or four separate puzzle pieces had just clicked together in her head. She had an answer. Police Rescue Six Children in Trafficking Ring Bust by Lara Chambers, January 27, 2015. Boston. Police rescued six children and a 29-year-old woman after busting a child trafficking ring based in Boston's Dorchester neighborhood. According to a statement put out yesterday evening by the Massachusetts State Police, the children, many suffering from malnutrition, remained unidentified Monday. The lone adult discovered with the children, identified as Cheska Dimagiba, is a Filipino national. There is no record of her entering the United States. The possibility of a crime in progress was uncovered by Globe staffers conducting an investigative report, and the paper subsequently made a full report to police. Acting on the tip, police raided a warehouse in Dorchester two nights ago. Further investigation revealed a cache of food and clothing, and ultimately led police to a room described as a hidden dungeon. Witness statements and other evidence indicate this warehouse was the scene of more than one crime. Justin Speer, communications director for the Boston Police Department, told The Globe, "These crimes were not committed by a single individual." Asked for the identities of the perpetrators, Speer said. The property owner was identified and apprehended without incident. He, in turn, gave us the names of three other individuals. Two have been arrested, and we are currently seeking a third. We will not release their names at this time. The Globe has uncovered evidence of an association with the Archdiocese of Boston. While the Archdiocese is not the de facto owner of the warehouse, documents indicate financing was arranged 2 years ago by Cardinal Hamilton Odell as part of the church's youth refuge program. Furthermore, Cardinal Odell is named personally as a lien holder on the property, indicating a financial relationship. The Archdiocese describes their financial involvement as little more than a legal technicality. We have numerous programs focused on community revitalization, said a spokesperson. Those programs can involve loans made to low-income individuals. The Archdiocese was not aware of any illegal activity. Cardinal Odell's personal attorney, when reached for comment, said, We're talking about a man who spent 8 years in Boston working to help its residents, and that includes helping to finance projects in neglected neighborhoods. To me, this is a case of no good deed goes unpunished. I suspect we'll find this is nothing more than another witch hunt by the city of Boston. The property owner and other suspects are being held without bond. They are due to be arraigned Tuesday. Chapter 17. In the end, it was a mistake that broke the code wide open. Like the discovery of the heating properties of microwaves, or of the cosmic microwave background radiation, Lara stumbled onto the answer blindly. It happened while she was sitting at a scarred table in the basement of the Orange County Library. The library's basement stack stretched the length of the building, floor-to-ceiling metal shelves supporting the concentrated knowledge of history scientists, artists, and philosophers. No one in Hillsborough seemed particularly interested, though. She hadn't seen another human being for at least 2 hours. No one heard her groan and crumple up her papers after the first hour. No one heard her slam a fist into the tabletop after the second. Windows admitted long bands of sunlight that contracted as the time moved toward noon, until the fluorescent lights were her only company, buzzing away as she rubbed the sore spot on her palm and cursed herself. Could she really have been so wrong? Maybe the best thing to do would be to revisit the entire project, re-examine her assumptions. Somewhere in there was the answer. She could feel it. A 5-minute break was in order. She walked up and down the aisles, working out the stiffness from hunching over too long. Then she walked back to her table with fresh eyes. Papers covered the top, but two in particular stood at the center. First was the photograph of Teresa Mitchum's skin, stretched back to its normal size. The tattoo was clearly visible. The numbers, even tiny, were perfectly legible. 8, 27, 4, 4, 3, 5, 4, 9, 4, 4, 8, 2, 3, 6, 3, 7, 11, 37, 3, 6, 3, 3, 8, 27, 3, 6, 3, 7, 8, 27, 8, 27, 11, 51, 11, 37. 36 numbers in total, etched into the skin in a grid. 6 rows of 6 numbers. 6 columns of 6 numbers. A perfect square. When it was a 2-digit number, the kid had taken care to mold it into its space in the grid. His work was nothing if not symmetrical. In retrospect, something about her phone call from the man claiming to be the kid stood out. He'd said he was following her. He'd meant it first as a journalist, that he was reading her stories. Then he'd made it personal. Once she'd known he was out there, watching, waiting. All references to news articles had blown out of her head as if hit by a hurricane. This morning, during therapy, Jasmine's comment had forced a jagged shard into place. In the moment before fear had taken her over, Laura had assumed he was talking about her articles in the Gazette, the coverage of his own crimes. But he had mentioned another article, a Globe article, and it seemed a strange one to bring up considering the conversation. She picked up a printout of her story from 3 years ago. Now marked up with her notes, and read it one more time. Why this specific article? The kid had said it was because of her empathetic treatment of a monstrous man. Indeed, Hamilton Odell was a monster, and she'd remembered the article the moment the kid mentioned it. But there wasn't anything particularly empathetic about the story, just straight-ahead reporting. It didn't make sense. Then Jasmine's story about her childhood love shook something loose. Forced to communicate in secret, they had relied on the same copy of Romeo and Juliet to hide their messages. It was one of the most basic ways to conceal information. A book code. Book codes were about as simple as cipher could get. Choose an agreed-upon text, say, a specific edition of the Bible, and then send your message by referencing the letters. Send a message like second page, fourth line, eighth letter, and it leads to H. Fifth page, second line, tenth letter, you get I. Together, they spell high. Whole messages could be constructed in a similar fashion. The thing that had grabbed Laura's attention was the numbers. Once a code was agreed upon, most book codes used a numerical abbreviation. High would be rendered something like 2-4-8, 5-2-10, with not a letter to be seen. She ran a finger down the photograph of the tattoo. Could it really be that simple? The book code had other advantages. Despite its simplicity, it was nearly impossible to crack. There were too many books in the world. Even for a computer, finding the right one would take hundreds of years. But what if she already knew which book? What if it wasn't a book at all? What if it was a newspaper article? First, she arranged the numbers in order. The organization of the numbers into a grid meant they could be read up and down or side to side. For the sake of moving forward, she assumed they would be read in a normal left-to-right, top-to-bottom fashion. When she finished, she had a long string of them. 8, 27, 4, 4, 3, 5, 4, 9, 4, 4, 8, 2, 3, 6, 3, 7, 11, 17, 3, 6, 3, 3, 8, 27, 3, 6, 3, 7, 8, 27, 8, 27, 11, 51, 11, 37. Next, she tried to match them to the globe story. The difficulty was that she didn't know exactly how they related to each other and to the article. If they were supposed to indicate, say, sentence, word, then letter, she should organize them into groups of three numbers each. She tried it and got utter gibberish, no matter how she sliced it. She thought maybe it was an anagram and tried reorganizing the letters but couldn't come up with anything. She went back to the list of numbers and stared at it again. The highest number was 51, and the lowest was 2. But the distribution was off. The lower numbers were favored by a huge margin. Assuming they indicated sentence and letter, wouldn't there be an easier way to do it? Lara tried to recreate the same message, gibberish though it was, and found she could locate all the necessary letters much earlier in the article. There was no need to use, say, sentence 11, just to indicate a U and a T. Just to make it more difficult, maybe? No, the very creation of a code had a certain logic to it. Even if he was insane, clearly he had the acumen to put something like this together. She would have to assume the code was a product of some kind of logic. Otherwise, it would be impossible to make any progress at all. Assuming this is a book code at all, and assuming this is the right text, she thought. She decided to stick with her interpretation of the list of numbers as ordered pairs and organize them as such. 8-27, 4-4, 3-5, 4-9, 4-4, 8-2, 3-6, 3-7, 11-17, 3-6, 3-3, 8-27, 3-6, 3-7, 8-27, 8-27, 11-51, 11-37. Right away, she knew she was onto something. There were too many repeats for it to be a coincidence. 8-27 appeared 4 times. 3-6 appeared 3 times, while 3-7 and 4-4 both appeared twice. She was looking at a pattern. The second thing that jumped out at her was the distribution of the low numbers. If she looked just at the first number in any given pair, the highest they went was 11. Counting sentences didn't work. What if the first number referenced paragraphs? The article had only 9. She tried it anyway. Gibberish again. God damn it. She rubbed her eyes and started again. This time she would try paragraphs and words. Carefully, she counted down to the 8th paragraph, and then across to the 27th word, 3. Almost immediately, she realized her mistake. Her eyes were getting tired. All the parts of the page were starting to blend together. She had counted down from the very top of the page, including the headline, the byline, and the date. She'd ended up on what was really the 5th paragraph, the one that began with the word asked. She sighed and began to start over, then stopped again. Something caught her eye. It seemed unlikely he had started at the top. But say, just for a second, that he had. Then paragraph 8 appeared twice, as 8-27 and 8-2. And 8-27 was the word 3. And 8-2? It only took her a second to count it out. 8-2 led to the word 4. She stared at the words for a second, turning the paper back and forth. 3 and 4. Her pulse began to quicken. Again, she didn't believe landing on 2 numbers, even if one was misspelled, could be a coincidence. Something else stood out. The most common first number was 3, and that would indicate the line with the date, January 27, 2015. A quick scan confirmed her suspicions. The date provided 2, 7, 0, 1, and 5, and in the text were the words 3, 4, 6, 8, and the number 9. With a little creative reading, this article made it possible to encode all 10 digits. She started working it out in order. 8-27 would be 3. 4-4 would be 6. For 3-5, she counted January and then each individual number as its own word. 3-5 was 0. 4-9 meant 9. 4-4 was 6 again. And 8-2 equaled 4. Cautiously, piece by piece, she put it together. It was all numbers again. Numbers translated into numbers. Then she got to the last two pairs. Paragraph 11. Words 51 and 37. She gasped. Her own handwriting stared back from the paper, dancing in the light, mocking her, forming her own private message from a monster. 360, 964, 15817, 31533, FINDME. Find me. There was no doubt she had cracked the code. She read the two words again and again. Without punctuation, there was no inflection. The phrase seemed to lose all meaning. Find me. She couldn't tell if he was daring her or begging her. Find me. But how? And then she sat back in her chair, wide-eyed. The last piece of the puzzle clicked into place. Find me implied a location. And those numbers. She scribbled them out again. 36.096415, comma, 81.731533. Her blood ran cold. Coordinates. A location. It wasn't just a tattoo. It was an invitation. An invitation printed on a young girl's skin. Doubt gripped her. Could that really be the truth? The message didn't include north, south, east, or west, and she couldn't remember which ones would be near the United States. But it only took her a second to find a website that would match decimal coordinates to locations. She decided to try them all. It quickly became apparent that the area around 37 degrees south, 90 degrees west, was located in the South Pacific, about 800 miles off the coast of Chile. 37 degrees south, 90 degrees east, landed her in the Indian Ocean, more than 1,000 miles west of Australia. 37 degrees north, 90 degrees east, put her in the corner of Xinjiang Province, northwest China. The last one was much closer. The website offered a more detailed map. She zoomed in, then found the latitude line, and used her finger to trace a line across the map from left to right. She located the longitude line and slashed her other finger downward, then drew them together at the intersection. Close-knit topographical curves nestled deep in a sea of green marked the Blue Ridge Mountains, part of the Pisgah National Forest. The spot was in North Carolina, only about 170 miles west of Hillsboro, little more than a three-hour drive from the very spot she was standing. Find me. The words would echo in her dreams. She could feel it. She tapped the location on the map once more. The message couldn't be clearer. X marks the spot. Chapter 18. The Dart's flat blue paint had been sucking up the sun for hours, even in the relative cool of 80-something degrees. Even with the windows down, the air inside had turned to soup and the cracked leather seats boiled. None of it reached Laura, who sat in the driver's seat, minute after minute, doing nothing. The keys hung in one hand. She pressed her forehead to the steering wheel and let it burn into her flesh. Hoped it would knock something loose. Her hands wouldn't stop shaking. Adrenaline, she told herself, and ignored them. It was everything she wanted. A story that readers wouldn't turn away from, that editors couldn't afford to ignore. Yesterday, it had held bushels of mystery and inherent drama, enough of both to make it a hit. But today, with a message like that tattooed into a chunk of flesh, it would be a sensation. She pinched herself, tried to wake up. In her head, she was already writing the book. It would make a hell of a book, a bestseller that would give back everything Boston had taken away. Her self-respect, her career, her escape from this godforsaken town. All of it had just been handed back to her on a silver platter. All she had to do was reach out and take it. She peeled her forehead off the steering wheel and looked at herself in the mirror, rubbed the angry red mark it had left on her skin, flinched at the sensation of touching her own flesh. Perry Mortem. Everything that had happened to Teresa Mitchum so far had happened while she was still alive. There was no reason to think that had changed. Charging up there with a camera, a notepad, and a pencil might make a great story, but it also might make that little girl dead. An image crowded into her head. Teresa, 10 years old and tied to a table somewhere in the Blue Ridge Mountains, tattooed hour by hour, the relentless buzzing of the gun as he carved into her, hearing that sound every time he turned it on. The harbinger of pain, the horror of anticipation. And then to have her skin flayed off? She couldn't imagine it, could not even wrap her head around it. The very thought of... She snapped out of her reverie, crawled out of whatever dark hole she'd fallen into, realized she'd been punching the dash over and over. The knuckles of her right hand were already swollen. Blood ran from an open cut. She reached out and touched the blood, winced. "God damn it," she said. And just like that, she made her decision. The engine turned over once, caught, then sputtered and died. She turned the key again and punched the gas a few times, careful not to flood it. "Come on." She turned the key again. A new sound came from the car, a creak of metal grinding. She ignored it and twisted the key harder. "Come on," she yelled and pushed the gas pedal to the floor. Metal shrieked against metal. The engine coughed one last time, and thin black smoke began issuing from under the hood. Running 2 blocks soaked her in sweat. She had a message from the kid, and a possible location for Teresa Mitchum known to no one else in the world. It seemed unfathomable. If anything happened to Laura, the poor girl would never be found. Desperation flooded through her. She carried a dangerously fragile secret. It needed to spread. To survive, it burned to get out. Finally, at the corner of Wake and Margaret, she took a breath, pulled out her phone, and called Tim. The line rang 4 times before his voicemail clicked on. She hung up and dialed again. "Motel?" Elias Quant answered. "Elias, it's Laura Chambers."
"Motel here," he said again.
She could picture him flipping through one of his Dutch magazines, barely able to hear her over the phone. "I need to get in touch with Agent Tominski. Please connect me with his room."
"Tominski?"
Quant repeated.
"Yes."
"Which one is he?"
Laura suppressed the urge to bang her phone against a brick wall.
"Don't you have a register?"
"Oh, it's around here somewhere,"
he said in his precise, accented English. She gritted her teeth.
"He's about 40, bushy eyebrows, probably the only current guest who's a goddamn FBI agent. Is it coming back to you?"
"No need for such language, Miss Chambers."
She said nothing.
"Yes, I do in fact remember him. Room 4, I'll connect you now."
The phone rang and rang. Laura let it go on for 3 or 4 minutes, hoping Tominski was in the shower or otherwise occupied, that if she let it go on long enough, eventually he'd pick it up. He didn't. She hung up, dialed again.
"Motel?"
"Elias, he didn't answer."
"Now that you mention it, his car is gone. I suspect he may not be in right now."
"God damn it."
"No need for such language, Miss Che."
She pressed end, and then shoved the phone down into her pocket. The sheriff's station was only another 2 blocks away. McKinney looked younger in person. He was at least 50. She could remember him campaigning against Don Rogers during an election back in the day. But up close, the steel gray running through his hair served only to contrast against perfectly tanned skin, oily black eyes, and a jawline that would make Superman weep.
"Sheriff McKinney," she said.
He didn't bother to look up, but gestured for her to take a seat and kept scratching away at the top of a stack of papers. She waited, hands folded in her lap, and when 2 minutes had passed, and he hadn't even so much as grunted in her direction. She tried again.
Sheriff McKinney,
she repeated.
I'll be with you when I'm ready, Miss Chambers.
He kept riding. Sir, it's quite urgent.
You know what I'm working on here?
No, of course you don't.
Let's just say it's official police business.
Official police business.
You understand what that is?
Of course you do.
It's not scribbles on a piece of paper.
No, here we deal with matters of life and death, Miss Chambers. Life and death. That means it's important.
Sheriff, I'm sure it's important, but I'm here
because the rules of civilized society apparently mean fuck all to you reporters.
That's why you're here in my office during the hour I set aside specifically to catch up on this paperwork.
You think I like doing paperwork?
That was not an invitation to speak, Miss Chambers. And it's not like the question needed an answer.
Of course I don't like doing paperwork. It's about as fun as licking a porcupine. But it keeps things moving, keeps the wheels turning. It has to be done, for the good of a civil society.
Sir, please, you need to pay attention. He brought one ham-sized fist down onto the desk and rattled every gold trophy on the shelves behind him.
That was not an invitation to speak, Miss Chambers,
he roared at her.
You come into my office, wasting my valuable time. You constantly interrupt me, and now you're telling me how to do my job.
He ticked her offenses off on his fingers, one by one.
We are not off to a good start, ma'am. No, we are not. That's what you damn reporters just can't seem to understand. Rules exist for a reason. There are no arbitrary rules. We may think them so, but I promise you, every rule ever created by the mind of man or God was in response to some problem, some defect in our very nature. I count myself among the defective, Miss Chambers, and that is the beginning.
He sat back in his chair and seemed to be waiting for her to speak. She saw no choice but to indulge him.
The beginning of what?
Of understanding what we do here in this building.
Maybe I could write a feature about you someday.
His nose wrinkled.
If I get my wish, this will be the very last time we ever speak.
In that case, let's get down to brass tacks. I think I know where Teresa Mitchum is being kept.
McKinney's face went through a remarkable transformation. First, his eyes widened in surprise, and his mouth hung open. He started to speak, stopped himself, and the lantern jaw swung shut like a bear trap. The eyes narrowed into thin, oblong pools, and she could almost see the calculations running behind his eyes.
Say that again,
she repeated herself. McKinney took a breath.
Do you know, ma'am, that making a false police report is a crime in the state of North Carolina?
It doesn't matter, because this isn't a false report.
Listen to me.
Those numbers tattooed on the skin. I figured out what they mean. He stood abruptly.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Bullshit. I saw the official pictures.
If you've seen any official pictures, as you claim, the very act of letting you see them would be illegal. As far as I'm concerned, you've just reported a crime.
She shook her head, dismissing him outright. Not at all. I'm a journalist. This person was a source. No crime was committed.
That is my determination to make.
Well, I'm not giving you a name, so good luck with that. He rested his huge palms flat on the desk and leaned forward until he towered over her.
I don't know how they do things in Boston.
He spit the last word like a curse.
But down here, I tell you how things run. You want to make a First Amendment case about it? Fine. Just remember your place. In here, you and I might as well be all alone together.
His eyes drifted down across her body, then back up to her face. The corner of his mouth turned up into a cruel smile. She shivered, then tried to put away her disgust.
Look, I'm sorry if I'm stepping on your toes here, but this is something you need to hear. It's just like you said, a matter of life and death.
He didn't sit down, didn't even move, just kept staring at her.
Okay, tell me how you managed to understand this killer's message when everyone else is so baffled.
Because he called me.
And told you what it meant,
McKinney said slowly.
No, he mentioned an article I wrote years ago, and I thought it might be a book code, and I played around with it until I found a good match, the key.
She trailed off. A deep, raspy sound had started somewhere deep in the man's chest. He began shaking. With a start, she realized he was holding in laughter. Then he couldn't hold it anymore. A throaty chuckle filled the office.
He called you? He spoke to you in code?
McKinney managed. Look, he gave you the code too. Is it really so difficult to believe?
As quickly as it had started, the laughter stopped. McKinney's face turned back to stone. He sat down and started scratching at his reports again.
Sheriff, I think we're done here, he said.
She couldn't believe it. It was like living a nightmare. To have the knowledge of what might be Teresa Mitchum's exact location, and to be rebuffed by the very man charged with finding her, was nothing less than surreal.
The girl who cried wolf, she thought.
Except that she'd never in her life lied to this man. Embarrassed him, maybe, but never lied.
Is your pride really so important you can't let me help you? She asked.
He didn't bother looking up.
Help from a woman like you is worthless, he sighed,
like he was letting her in on some foregone conclusion.
It'd just be a waste of my time.
Where's Frank Stewart? I need to speak with him.
I'm not here to pass messages between lovers. This isn't middle school.
I need to see Deputy Stewart, right now. He glanced up.
Deputy Stewart, who we know is your source, is on suspension. Maybe permanently.
Despite all the promises she had made to herself, promises about all the things she would refuse to do again, she decided to tell him. She'd already thrown away her chance at the story. In for a penny, in for a pound. Frank Stewart is not my source, she said. I'll swear to that on the record. But Sheriff McKinney just shook his head.
He never should have trusted you.
Chapter 19. She banged on Frank's door. After what felt like an hour but was probably more like 3 minutes, the door swung open. She barged past him into the living room and started spreading papers out onto the coffee table.
Laura,
he said, his voice a harsh whisper. She glanced up at him. You look terrible. It seemed like he'd lost 10 pounds. There were dark hollows under his cheeks, black circles under his eyes. He wore a tank top that had been white once, now yellowed with overuse.
Well, I feel like shit too, he said.
What happened?
What the fuck do you think happened? They fired me, Laura, with prejudice. I'm done as a cop in Orange County. And what kind of recommendation do you think McKinney will give me?
He ran a hand down his face.
I'm done as a cop, period.
Maybe not in a big city, she said.
That's your dream, not mine.
Besides, I heard you're just suspended.
Administrative bullshit. It takes time to get the paperwork through. But believe me, I'm fired.
She patted the couch cushion. Sit with me a minute. All the fight had gone out of him. He folded himself into the space next to her, and she could smell his sickly sweet stench. Warm booze mixed with body odor.
I told him you're not the source. Who?
McKinney.
You told him?
He repeated slowly. Yes, I marched into his office, let him fire off a few salvos about my worth, or lack thereof, as a reporter, and about you being my source. And then I corrected him. I told him it wasn't you. I told him I'd go on the record if I had to. His eyes widened.
And?
She glanced away. He didn't believe a word I said.
But you'll go on the record. If you do that, I don't think he can fire me.
Maybe so, maybe not. Look, Frank, I want to be straight with you. I didn't visit McKinney to go to bat for you. I went because I know where to find Teresa Mitchum. He froze.
Did you hear me? She asked. He picked up an open bottle of whiskey and took a swig.
I heard you.
She tried to pry it out of his hands, but he pushed her away and pulled on the bottle again. Frank, I need you sober.
Is this what you told McKinney? That you know where the Mitchum girl is?
He grimaced as he swallowed.
No wonder he didn't take you seriously.
I know you're hurting. I know what a job can mean to a person. Working the right job, the whole world just makes sense. Without it, everything seems pointless.
He glanced at her out of the corner of his eye, then drank again.
But you didn't become a cop just to wear a badge and carry a gun, did you?
Hell no.
Then why?
He said nothing. She slipped a picture out of the folder in her hand and held it up for him to see.
This is why.
He stared at it. A girl's ear so small and perfectly formed it looked fake, like it was made of plastic. His face didn't react, but he nodded.
So let's help her.
Frank considered her for a second, seemed to come to an internal decision, and set his jaw. He nodded again. Even a few days ago, he would never have accepted such flimsy evidence. But getting fired had changed him. He was willing to listen, ready to take a risk. What did he have to lose? Step by step, she walked him through the process that had led to her conclusions. The phone call, her therapist's mention of book codes, the critical inductive leap between the kid's mention of that one specific article, and the numbers delivered to the police. Through it all, Frank tried to stop her, tried to ask questions, but she steamrolled right over him. Once she started talking, she couldn't stop. The story poured out, fact after fact, a terrible crescendo of human misery, leading inexorably to that green smudge on the map. When she was finished, he examined the spot pinned down by her index finger, deep in the national forest, then glanced up.
You're seeing a therapist?
She gaped at him.
That's your first question?
I'm not crazy, Frank.
He looked up at the ceiling, scratched the underside of his jaw, then looked back at her.
Was it something I did that made you go?
Christ, maybe this was a mistake. She started shuffling the papers back into her bag.
Laura, I'm not saying you're wrong.
No?
No, you convinced me.
She said nothing.
I mean it. I'm convinced.
Okay. She sat back down, relief that someone had finally believed the story flooding through her. Now what do we do about it? He glanced down at the bottle in his hand as though surprised it was there, then set it aside.
McKinney didn't believe you. You still talking to that FBI guy?
Who do you mean?
He just shook his head.
Come on, Laura. I'm not that dumb. No one in the sheriff's office is stupid enough to have anything to do with you. Me excluded, of course. Who else could have fed you material like that?
He pointed at the few photos still strewn across the table. Laura gave a single small nod. If she wanted his help, this was the price of admission.
Tominski, right?
Another nod. He's out at Elias Quant's place. I tried him earlier, but no answer.
So try him again, he said.
So she did, let his cell ring to voicemail, went through the whole routine with Quan again, but got no response. She called back and got the old man to agree to check the room himself. 10 minutes later, her phone rang, and she snatched it up.
I apologize, Miss Chambers, Quan said. I knocked for quite some time, and against my better judgment, I opened the door. No one in residence.
Thanks, she said and ended the call. Frank rubbed his face and his hands again, checked his watch.
It's just us, she muttered.
What's that?
I said it's just us. We could sit here waiting for him to come back, but every second we do nothing, Teresa Mitchum will be another second closer to dying.
If she's still alive, Frank said.
Don't even say it. She was alive when he cut off her ear.
Doesn't mean he kept her that way.
Think about it like this. If she's dead, then we can be careful, take our time, think this thing through. But if she's alive, we have to move.
Laura took a breath.
We'd have to do something, wouldn't we?
If she was alive, there's no way to tell.
She stood. Hope for the best, plan for the worst, right? But let's plan for the best. We need to assume she's alive and act accordingly. So that on the off chance that she is,
I can save her.
Frank finished.
We can save her.
He shook his head.
You're a reporter. There's no way I can take you up there with me.
She started shuffling the papers into her bag again. It's a package deal. If you want to go up there, you're taking me with you.
Give me the coordinates.
I put in the work. I figured it out. I've thrown away what could have been the biggest story of my career on the off chance we can save that girl. We can save her. You're not leaving me behind.
Laura.
He grabbed her hand, then started to pry the cell phone from between her fingers. She tried to stop him, tried to hold on to it as tightly as possible. They stood there, like opposing sides before the start of a tug of war, just waiting for the whistle. Then he put a flat hand on her chest and pushed. She tumbled backward onto the couch. He stood above her, phone in hand, looking sheepish.
I'm sorry, he said.
Don't do this.
It's for your own good.
For my good? Listen to yourself. All you want to do is play the hero. If you really cared about that little girl, you'd take any help you could get.
It's for your own good. You'll thank me later.
She turned away, her face on fire, burning to spit at him or to deliver some cutting remark that would throw his selfishness into perspective. Turning back, she opened her mouth. But he was already gone. Down on the street, a truck's engine turned over and tires squealed against the road as he took off for the highway. A gray wooden shack with a tin roof served as the Orange High Photography Lab. It was out near the football field. In some prior life, it had probably been the equipment shed. Laura had been interested in journalism even in high school. She knew where it was, only about a mile and a half from Frank Stewart's apartment. School wasn't in session, but she sprinted there anyway. This was her last chance. She knocked, and the door opened right away. Leon Bowden, wearing the same black t-shirt and black jeans, pushed that long hair out of his eyes and raised his shoulders. He didn't speak, but the message was clear. What gives? You have a car, Leon?
Sure, Miss Chambers.
Is it that one? She pointed back toward the school parking lot, empty save a single vehicle. A beige Ford Taurus, more rust than car.
Miss Chambers?
If I've told you once, I've told you a million times. Call me Laura. Is it that one?
Yes.
Okay, that'll have to do. Get your camera, get the keys. We're leaving right now. Chapter 20.
There's no one around for miles. If something goes wrong, we're screwed. Are you sure we should do this?
She looked at Leon and frowned. The last thing she needed was a reluctant partner. All her focus had to be on finding the girl. Coddling a frightened high schooler would be a nightmare, especially out in these remote woods. But he wasn't wrong. Getting cold feet? She asked. That one simple question was enough to put a kink in his pride. He drew himself up as much as was possible while crouched in a laurel thicket and gave a tight-lipped shake of his head.
We've come this far, he said.
He whispered it, even though the cabin was at least 200 yards away. We've come this far. Distance traveled amounted to 180 miles. 3 hours on the highway, the last 30 minutes on roads progressively more bumpy and remote. Frank had taken her phone, and the coordinates along with them, but there had been nothing to stop her from working them out again. First, she made Leon drive her to the Chambers farm. Her mother had been asleep in her room, napping the afternoon away. Laura tiptoed down to the basement and found the corner where her father's things were stored. On a high shelf, behind a box of his old ashtrays, she found what she was looking for and pulled it down. The box was crafted of wood inlaid with gold trim. Inside, a velvet pad held the gun in its center. She lifted it out, a Browning High Power. Before he died, her father had taken her out into the fields a few times and let her plink cans. That's what he called it anyway. And she had thought it would be like using a BB gun. The first time she pulled the trigger, the gun had jumped back so hard it hit her in the face, splitting open her bottom lip. The sound cracked like a mile-long whip, so loud she couldn't hear afterward. Her father had pressed his grimy shirt cuff against the cut and let the blood thicken, then picked the gun up off the ground and pressed it back into her hands. Once she could hit her target more than 50% of the time, he'd said,
Now you're ready for the shotgun.
and she had learned to shoot that too, to brace herself and prepare for its incredible roar. She ran her finger down the side of the grip and remembered him doing the same thing while describing the invisible mechanics hidden inside. He'd told her all about it, how it was a knockoff of the Colt 1911 his own father had carried in World War II, how it was a decent copy, but still inferior to its inspiration, how a cheap knockoff was all he could afford. She lifted the heavy velvet lining out